All right. We thank you for joining us this evening on our live stream for the Eastside Church in Russellville, Alabama. And we encourage you to contact us if you have any questions about anything that we say during this broadcast, or any questions about our work in the area or our service times. And we'll do our best to get back with you as soon as we can. You can find our website at EastsideChurchRussellville.com. That's one word, EastsideChurchRussellville.com. And we hope you'll stop by. We've got a number of audio files available, sermons, Bible classes, some articles, and more information about our group and how to contact us. When we left off on Sunday night, we were kind of right in the middle of the story of Esther. And just for the maybe the sake of going through this kind of quickly, we'll remember the dates of the captivity. 605 is when Daniel was taken to Babylon. 597 BC is when Ezekiel the prophet and Jeconiah the king went to Babylon. And then finally in 586, the city was destroyed after a kind of a number of efforts to rebel and this refusal to submit to Nebuchadnezzar the way that Jeremiah had been, you know, telling the people in Judah and Jerusalem to do. God was using the Babylonians to punish Judah for their sins, and that things could go fairly well and they could serve the Babylonians and stay out of their own land, but they did not accept that. And so eventually God was pushed to the point of total devastation and destruction and judgment because of their continued disobedience. And they spent about 70 years in captivity going, if we kind of go back to 605, kind of counting that as a starting point for us, they spent about 70 years in captivity. And this had been predicted by Jeremiah. And we're in the period that we would think of as the return, although we have already seen that the return from captivity did not mean a complete return of every exiled Jew to the land of Judea. It mostly was the people of the southern kingdom, Judah, the people of Judah and Benjamin. And it was a remnant that came back to live in Jerusalem and kind of the towns and cities of Judah and Benjamin. The first group of captives came back in 538 BC. Lord willing, on Sunday, we'll begin talking about Ezra coming back with another group of captives in 458 BC. And then finally, Nehemiah came back in 445 BC to finish the walls of the city of Jerusalem. And the story of Esther fits in between kind of these two stages of the return. The seventh year of Artaxerxes was about 479 BC, and that's when Esther became the queen of Persia. So when we left off last week, we were kind of in this, let me get this off of here. I'll come back here. We were kind of in the middle of the story. Really, we might say not kind of. We had reached the point where Esther becomes queen, and Haman was promoted soon after that. It may be, if you kind of read there in chapter 3, I think, at the beginning of chapter 3, after these things, it talks about Haman casting the lot in the first month of the year. So it may be just at the beginning of the next year, so around 478 BC, when Haman was promoted to the pretty much what we might say the position of prime minister, the highest position in Persia, second only to the king. And he was all this honor was bestowed on Haman, but he was very proud and a wicked and selfish kind of man. And there was this conflict between him and Mordecai. Mordecai would not bow to Haman when he came by and passed through the gate. And there had been, you know, orders actually issued that the servants of the king ought to do this, ought to bow to Haman and show him reverence and respect. And we talked about some of the reasons, you know, why that was the case. It seems that it was really coming from a place of conscience for Mordecai rather than just stubbornness. Now there are some theories that would, you know, argue in favor of stubbornness, and they may be true, but for my part right now, so far as I understand, I'm not completely convinced that that's the case. And one of the reasons that I'm not convinced that Mordecai was just being stubborn is the fact that when when Mordecai, you know, when Haman's plot basically is hatched and this decree is sent out, you know, signed or sealed with the king's signet ring, you know, effectively making this decree of annihilation, annihilating the Jews, the law of the land. When that decree was sent out, you know, Mordecai did not change his behavior toward Haman. And it seems that he was aware of the fact that this had something to do with him and Haman's interactions. And yet the entire, you know, race of the Jews had become a target because of him, but he didn't change. And you would think that if it was just a matter of being stubbornness and he was truly as grieved as he, you know, was, you know, showing to be outwardly by mourning and wailing aloud in the streets and putting on sackcloth and ashes, that at that point that a grieved man would have made changes if he could have possibly. So that's just kind of my understanding of the story. And what has just happened, where at the point we get to in the book of Esther, is that, you know, Esther and Mordecai have communicated about this decree that has been basically instigated by Haman, but, you know, signed into law with the knowledge of the king. And Mordecai has urged Esther to go in and petition the king on behalf of the Jews. And Esther has talked about, you know, the law of, you know, the I guess the death sentence that was associated with going into the king without a summons. Now, there was an exception that could be granted, but there was no way to guarantee that that exception would be granted. And so they kind of have this conversation, and Mordecai, you know, some of the most, I guess, central words of the book, describing the circumstances of the book, Mordecai talks about, you know, the need for her to do what she knows is right in this situation, to not think that she will escape from, you know, the decree against the Jews just because she's in the palace, because law is law, you know, in the land of the Medes and the Persians. It cannot change. And there's no reason for her to think that she would escape. And so she needed to do what she knew was right. And it may very well be that she was, you know, raised up to royalty for this very moment to be in a position to speak on the behalf of the Jews and help to secure their deliverance. So Esther has just gone in to the king. And of course, before she went in, there was that fast declared for 3 days. She was fasting with her maids in the palace, and Mordecai and the Jews in the city of Susa were fasting. But Esther has gone in. She has been granted an exception, and the king has, you know, agreed to hear her petition and promised to give her whatever she would ask for. And she begins by inviting the king and Haman to a banquet that she has prepared. And at the banquet, the king asks her again what she wanted. And she says, well, I can't tell you right now. It just if I really have found favor in your sight, you and Haman come back to the banquet tomorrow, and I will surely tell you, you know, what is on my mind. What is my petition? And so Haman goes out, and of course, he's feeling great. You know, another honor, you know, another honor to kind of chalk off on his checklist, a special private banquet with him and the queen. But he sees Mordecai in the gate, and once again, Mordecai doesn't bow to him, and he goes home, and he's just kind of beside himself. He can't get over what he perceives as a personal slight to his honor and his position. And so his friends and his wife kind of advise him that, hey, he's got all this influence with the king. Why doesn't he just go ahead and build a gallows to hang Mordecai on, and to go early in the morning and request the king's permission to just go ahead and execute Mordecai? So that's where we left things. At the end of chapter 5, Haman did build the gallows, and he felt the advice, he thought it was a good idea. So you can just kind of imagine. So he's upset, you know, after running into Mordecai, but hey, you know, he's taking these steps, and he's pretty confident that things are, you know, he's going to be vindicated pretty quickly. So in chapter 6, we talked about providence. We talked about all these things that were anomalies that worked together to bring this Jewish orphan, first of all, into this position in the land where she had you know, incredible influence with the king, had power and authority herself as the queen. And we talked about the circumstances for the first queen to be removed and for the unusual choice of a bride that was made. Normally the bride of the king was chosen from a select group of families, but that wasn't the case on this occasion, opening the door for a Jewish orphan to become queen. And we talked about her relationship with Mordecai and his kind of moving about in the king's court and his awareness of circumstances. And what we're going to see by the end of this story is a complete reversal in favor of Mordecai, Esther, and the Jews. So here's this powerful man who's risen to this position of power, Haman, and he has it, you know, in his heart. He has his heart set on destroying these people whom he views as an affront to his honor. And you know, we see his wealth, his position, you know, even the gallows that he prepares for Mordecai become the instrument of Haman's own death. What we see is a complete and total reversal. And we, of course, believe by the providence of God, and I believe that Mordecai and Esther believed it was by the providence of God that this happened, because of the celebration, the feast that is instituted at the end of this book, so that they might never forget how they had been delivered. And it would become a constant opportunity for them to remember their deliverance and rejoice and to give thanks. So going into chapter 6, what happens is, leading to this reversal, we've got the king of Persia, and he can't sleep. He can't sleep. And so eventually he calls for the book of records to be brought before him for reading. And they're reading, and they come to the place in the records where, again, here's another, out of all the things they could have read, where do they land? They end up reading about the occasion when Mordecai had helped to foil a plot against the king's life. And the king asks, what has been done for Mordecai to honor him? Well, the servants tell him there's no record that anything's been done for him. And so the king immediately becomes very concerned about repaying this man who had saved his life. And so it just so happens, right? Just so happens, Haman is coming early. He wants to make his petition early. This is important to him. He's done his work. The gallows are ready. And he's going to, as soon as he can, take care of this matter. He's going to have some peace about it. And the king asks who is out in the court, and it's Haman. Well, who better? If the king wanted to ask the advice of someone, who better than his most trusted official, his highest ranking official? So yes, bring Haman in quickly. And so he asks Haman, what do you think the king should do for the man that he desires to honor? Well, Haman makes the fatal mistake of assuming that the king was talking about Haman. Well, Haman had received so much honor in the past. Surely the king is talking about honoring Haman even further. And so Haman, it seems, imagined what he would, you know, what he would like most of all. What way would he like to be honored? And he just, you know, described this scenario where the man was dressed in a robe, a royal robe that had been worn by the king. The man is paraded around the city square, sitting on a horse that had been ridden by the king. And a crown was to be set on the man's head. Basically, this, you know, what Haman is describing is a man being shown the same honor that would normally be reserved for the king. And one of the most noble princes should lead the man around the city square and cry out as he's going about, "This is what will be done for the man whom the king desires to honor." And the king thought, "This is a great idea. This is perfect, Haman. Go and do everything that you have just said for Mordecai the Jew." If you can just imagine how those words would have hit Haman's heart. He made the fatal mistake of assuming that the king was talking about him. And now Haman was being forced by the king. There's no way he could complain at this point. He is being forced by the king to go out and bestow this splendid honor on the man that he hated most. And I think there's a little bit of irony, a little bit of humor in the providence of God here, where, you know, and, you know, the Proverbs, the Psalms, you know, the wisdom literature talks about this, how evil schemes, you know, are often visited back upon the heads of the people who devise them. And there was something that I wanted to say. I think I'll maybe wait just a little bit, but I want to talk about the reversal of circumstances and how circumstances are really not a great indicator of, you know, where we are in our lives. We can see that, I think, from how quickly things change for Haman. And what the wisdom literature kind of indicates to us is that particularly when we are wicked, particularly when we are arrogant, that, you know, the way of God's dealings, he's still in control in the universe. The way of God's dealings tends to turn the wickedness that we devise back on ourselves. It eventually comes back. You know, sometimes it's described in different ways by different people, but I think people have observed this phenomenon that when you get busy trying to destroy someone else, many times you end up doing great harm to yourself, if not destroying yourself. And so the king, or Haman, you know, does everything that he's supposed to do. He goes home, though. He's very distressed. He's grieved. What does this turn of events mean? And he consults with his friends and his wife again, and his counselors tell him that if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, in verse 13, you will not overcome him, but you will surely fall before him. And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So there's two possibilities there when it says he will not be able to stand before Mordecai. This may be a statement that's based on the reputation of Yahweh. Now, the Persians, you know, had some dealings with the Jews, and the knowledge of the Jews, and the knowledge, a little bit of knowledge about their, you know, the God that the Jews worshiped. And so this may be a statement that's based on the reputation of Yahweh. Or they could be just saying, as pagans and idolaters, they could be saying or taking this as if the Jews and Mordecai are Haman's greatest enemy, then if Mordecai is beginning to rise above Haman, then that seems to be an omen, or they may be taking that as an omen that the gods are no longer with Haman in his quest for vengeance on Mordecai. Well, there's no time to talk about that because the servants come to, you know, escort Haman to the banquet, and there's probably no saying no to these servants. And it may be that Haman was glad to see the servants because, okay, well, maybe I'm not falling out of favor. The king still invited me to this special private banquet, so maybe I'm not falling out of favor. Maybe this is a good sign. Of course, you and I know, having the benefit of hindsight, that it's actually an act of divine providence preparing, you know, to call Haman into judgment, to bring him into account for his sins. So in chapter 7, the banquet is going on, and the king is interested in Esther's request. He is concerned with pleasing her. Something is bothering her. He doesn't know. It's got to be something pretty serious for her to risk her life to come in and petition the king. But he doesn't know precisely what it is. And so she says what she asks for basically is her life to be spared. Let my life be given to me as my petition, and my people as my request. That's what I ask for, king. My people and I have been sold to be destroyed, not to be slaves. We've been sold to be killed and to be annihilated. If we were just sold as slaves, I might not have said anything. We could have, you know, borne with that, and you know, God could have even delivered us out of that slavery. But we have been sold to be destroyed and annihilated. And the king, you know, Esther's lineage had been a secret. I don't know if anyone knows that Esther is a Jew until this point right here, except for Mordecai. And so the king has no idea what she's talking about. Who would do such a thing? Who has done this? And she identifies Haman as her adversary and her enemy. And it says in verse 6 that Haman became terrified before the king and queen. And it seems, you know, it seems that the king has put all the pieces together now. Now that he realizes when she identifies Haman, and you know, the king seems to not even have thought about the decree that he made a few months earlier. But now, when she identifies Haman, now he realizes, oh, this is what we have done. So when it is revealed that Esther is a Jew, Haman's plot, sounds like treason. But Haman probably didn't know that Esther was a Jew, if the king didn't know she was a Jew. But now his plot and his scheme sounds like treason. The king was very angry. And his attitude towards Haman is completely changed, because Haman is begging for his life and really had, it seems on this occasion, lost his sense of decorum, in the presence of the king and the queen, because it says that he fell on the couch where Esther was. And when the king came back in from the garden, it seems he went out maybe to clear his head, to think, maybe to keep from doing something rash right then and there. But he comes in and there's Haman, who is actually groveling, begging for his life. But the king sees it as an assault. And he says, will he even assault the queen while I'm in the house? And some of the servants seem to have heard and seen what's going on. And they just come realizing, how incensed the king is. And maybe even by the instruction of the king, they come and cover Haman's head and take him out, which is not a good sign for Haman. And the servants informed the king that Haman had in fact built a gallows to hang Mordecai on. And so the king just immediately gives the command, take Haman and hang him on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And they did. And it says at the end of verse 10 that the king's anger was subsided. And so here's where I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So circumstances, sometimes we put a lot of stock in circumstances, and we want things, to go a certain way. And we want our bank account to look a certain way. We want, our possessions to, to look a certain way. And there are some choices that we can make to have some effect on all of those things. We can make good choices. And, it can lead to good outcomes in our lives. But circumstances alone, are no indication of where we are in our lives, particularly in our relationship with God. Obviously, the Jews and Esther and Mordecai looked like those who were completely out of favor with God at one point in this story, but it wasn't. It was a challenge, in some ways it was a challenge for them to demonstrate their trust in God. And where would they turn? They had no power to rival Haman's when Haman's decree is issued. And so in David's life, when he's running from Saul, that was no indication of how God felt about David. But David had to get through that circumstance by trusting in God and waiting on God to do what he would do. David could not compromise his principles. David could not become like Saul and fight fire with fire, so to speak. He had to remain consistent with, his character and his devotion to God if he was to have any hope. Our circumstances can change very quickly. And another thing I would say here is, do you remember how pleased the king was previously when he had signed the decree? Here's Haman, his trusted advisor. And, he identifies a threat in the kingdom, and they've dealt with it, and he feels good about it. But now, once he begins to realize more of the particulars of what Haman had done, he sees it as a bad thing, which to me, as I was reading it, it demonstrates to me that we two things. First of all, it demonstrates that we need a moral standard. We need a moral lawgiver, and we need a standard to look to, so that we can, arrive at the same place when it comes to morality. Here, the same situation was bad at one time and then later, or it's good at one time and then later it's bad. It's the same situation, but it was not being measured by any kind of standard. And maybe the second thing that I think we learn is that we generally will need more information to understand whether decisions are good or bad. You know, just some, you know, big decisions probably don't need to be made in a moment unless we have to. But generally, we will probably have time. When you're talking about exterminating an entire race of people from the kingdom, you know, from any nation, it seems like that would give anybody, you know, pause. Okay, you've presented some good reasons here, maybe some reasons that I think I understand and agree with, but this is a big decision. You know, what are we doing? You know, is this really just? Is this really going to be best for the kingdom? So, you know, big decisions like that. First of all, we need a moral standard. Otherwise, we might find ourselves just going back and forth and looking at the same situation two different ways. One time it's good, another time it's bad. We need a standard to measure things by, and we probably are usually going to need time to think about complex questions and especially big, serious decisions. So there's no need to be hasty. Pray, wait on the Lord, study, think, and you know, at some point we will have to make decisions. We talked about that on Sunday. We will have to make decisions, but do that patiently and humbly, and we're going to have a better chance of avoiding. The king kind of put himself in this position, and you know, thankfully he's kind of in a position of absolute authority where, you know, the only person he really has to answer to is the people maybe that he cares about. And he's probably embarrassed and upset about the position that he's put Esther in. And we kind of see that in chapter 8. So in chapter 8, we see the house of Haman. Here's part of that reversal that we talked about. The house of Haman was given to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king because Esther reveals that Mordecai is her relative and, you know, had been her guardian. I assume for a while that all that came out, how Mordecai had been basically was the only family that Esther had in many ways. And so Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And we're going to see by the end of this chapter that Haman or the king gives his signet ring to Haman and Esther, you know, the position, or to Mordecai. All the honor that Haman had previously enjoyed and held is being conferred upon Mordecai. And that hatred and the object of destruction that the Jews had once been, they are now, you know, turning toward becoming an object of reverence and respect. We're going to see the reputation of the Jews and the respect that the people generally in the kingdom have for the Jews is completely turning around at this point. And so Esther implored the king to avert the evil scheme of Haman. In other words, the idea is to revoke the letters. Haman is dead and he has been punished, but his letters still exist as law. That date that had been set, the 13th day of the 12th month, you know, nothing had changed so far as the enemies of the Jews having the right to go out and annihilate the Jews in all the provinces. And so the queen, you see, it says the king extended this golden scepter to Esther. Esther, again, you know, took her life in her hands and went before the king uninvited. And of course, again, on this occasion, the king extended the exception to her by allowing her to come in, even though she wasn't invited. And she says, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman in verse 5. And what the king is going to end up saying at the end of verse 8 is that anything written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. And so that's the reason. It might seem like a strange way to deal with this problem, but, you know, on a number of occasions, the unchanging law of the Medes and Persians had kind of, you know, backed, you know, some of the, you know, you remember Darius the Mede. He could not release Daniel from the decree that he had signed because the law of the Medes and the Persians does not change. The same principle is kind of in effect here. That's why this kind of weird solution is worked out. Instead of just canceling that day of annihilation, they can't do that. That's just not how the laws work. But the king told Esther and Mordecai that he would give them his signet ring and let them write the letters, you know, determining whatever conditions they thought would be necessary for the Jews to defend themselves or to escape annihilation. And he would give those letters all the same, the same consent and authority that had been given to the letters of Haman. And so in verse 9, it says that the king's scribes were called and they began to write these letters. It was the 23rd day of the third month in verse 9, this process began. They're writing all these letters to the various provinces in the various languages. And this is all being basically dictated by Mordecai in verse 9. Mordecai, it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews and the satraps and the governors of all the princes of the provinces. And he wrote in the name of the king in verse 10, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent the letters by couriers on the horses. They're riding with language here that just, you know, I think is intended to convey the best horses available for these couriers. And here's what the letters allowed the Jews to do. They were allowed to defend themselves. They were allowed to assemble together rather than, you know, being viewed as rebels. They were allowed to assemble together and defend their lives and their property. And they were allowed to kill anyone who tried to harm them on this day that had been set previously by Haman. And so in verse 13, a copy was issued as law in each and every province and was published to all the peoples. And of course, the couriers are hurrying to make sure that this information gets out. The empire was vast, and they're delivering these, you know, letters on horses. So you know, the couriers are hurrying so to get the word out there. Verse 15, it says, Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor in each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. Couple of things that I want to maybe say here. First of all, you just kind of notice this last section here that I think chapter 10 may be a stronger case is made, but I think there is a case being made here that Mordecai, there was a different attitude toward Mordecai maybe than toward Haman, that Mordecai had been exalted to this position and the people were happy about it. You know, if the people are happy about it, that indicates, I think, in their minds, an improvement in the circumstances. So the people generally seem to be happy about it. It says the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. Not just the Jews, the people rejoiced to see Mordecai exalted to this position. And then the Jews rejoiced, and of course this Mordecai's character and Mordecai's promotion reflected favorably on the Jews, you know, their reputation, and all the proceedings reflected favorably upon the Jews, because it says many of the people became Jews because the dread of the Jews or the fear of the Jews had fallen on them. I take that to mean that the people of the nations saw the providence of a great God in the protection of the Jews. They had all seen the same letter that had, you know, basically legalized the annihilation of the Jews from the kingdom. And now here comes the promotion of Mordecai, the discovery that Esther is a Jew, and this second decree that goes out, giving the Jews the right to defend themselves against those who would attack them. The Jews hadn't picked up a sword, and there isn't any indication that Esther or Mordecai or any Jew gained the king's favor by excellent speech, like they tricked him or they duped him or they were just such great orators. You know, they just did what they were supposed to do. Mordecai's loyalty to the king in uncovering that plot against his life led to his honoring And then Haman's hatred of, you know, Mordecai for a reason that seemed to be baseless to the king, probably seems to be baseless to us, you know, just brought about this change in circumstances, and it reflected, you know, positively on all the Jews, and it reflected positively on God. Many of the people became Jews. And of course, I think that we might find that statement interesting, living as Christians who are trying to share the gospel of Christ with our neighbors. And I would just say that we talked about providence. We talked about Mordecai's trust in God. We talked about their fasting and what seems to clearly be an appeal to God as they try to take steps to find deliverance through appealing to the king. All of that, you know, led to this reversal and God working with the people and showing favor for them. And many of the people became Jews. One of the most important things that we can do to reach our neighbors, to reach our family, to reach people that we care about, is to just simply show others that we trust God, to show others that we live for God, to show others that we rejoice in God, that we hope in God. When circumstances deteriorate, we turn to God, that our lives are truly built around seeking God and trusting God. There are people who are watching us. And I would just say that if we don't do that, we should not expect to be very effective in helping our families, helping our neighbors to come to Christ. So that seems to be a powerful lesson that we learn from everything that transpires and the attitude of the people generally now toward Mordecai and the Jews. So in chapter 9, the 12th month has arrived, that day that Haman had set by his former decree. And, you know, there were a lot of people who were still willing to fight the Jews, even though all the circumstances, all the advantages had kind of been tipping in the Jews' favor, going all the way back to the day when Mordecai and Esther had declared a fast among the Jews. But they seemed to be reaching a point. There were many people who were willing to fight the Jews, which may be surprising to us because obviously the king is friendly toward the Jews. Obviously the queen is a Jew. Obviously the prime minister, the highest official in the land, is a Jew. And we even see that the Persian officials, when they get involved in the conflict, it seems to be to help the Jews. They're not on the side of the enemies of the Jews. And we might say, well, why would anybody fight against the Jews at this point? Well, you may remember that pride and hatred can make you do some pretty foolish things. And you may remember that the Egyptians went after the Israelites, even after the 10 plagues. After being devastated by the miraculous power and the miraculous judgment of the God of Israel, the Egyptians still, in their pride, went chasing after the Israelites. There were some wicked people like Haman who viewed the Jews as enemies, who were probably covetous, if for no other reason than, hey, we will kill these Jews and take their stuff, and it's all legal. Now, whatever their motivation might have been, there were still a good number of people who were willing to fight against the Jews. And it says in verse 1, they hope to gain the mastery over them. But here's another statement of reversal that was accomplished by the providence of God. It was turned to the contrary, so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. And so the Jews assembled in their cities. They did exactly what the law indicated that they ought to do. In verse 3, we see the princes of the provinces assisted the Jews because the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Every advantage is on the side of the Jews. And so what it basically ends up being a rout. It's not much of a fight. Those who hate the Jews are just completely squashed. In verse 4, Mordecai was great, and he became greater and greater. the Jews struck all their enemies with a sword. They did what they pleased to those who hated them. So, you know, the Jews weren't going out hunting their enemies. All they were doing was defending themselves and their properties, their property, and they routed their enemies. In verse 6 through 10 there, the 10 sons of Haman were killed in Susa, and their names are given. But they did not lay their hands on any of the plunder. And you know, notice that is said every time an account of Jewish victory is given here in chapter 9. In verse 5, the number of those who were killed was reported to the king. It was listed back in verse 6. 500 people were killed in the capital city and the 10 sons of Haman. Queen Esther, you know, the king hears the report and Queen Esther, it says, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? What is your petition? The king's question seems to be, is there anything else that you feel like you need to feel like the Jews have finally escaped Haman's plot? So basically, you know, it's the king coming back and even asking, what else can be done? What else needs to be done? And so she asked in Susa, apparently there was some rumor or some concern that the enemies of the Jews would try to fight against the Jews on the next day as well. And so she asked if it could be granted again for the Jews in Susa to defend their property like they had before, and that the 10 sons of Haman be hung on the gallows. And basically kind of a public display, a warning, you know, those who behave like these men will suffer the same fate as these men. And so the king allowed it. And the next day they killed 300 more in the city. But it says in verse 15, they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Now, according to the original letters of Mordecai, they had every right to plunder their spoil in chapter 8 and verse 11, but they didn't. And even when the number is given in verse 16, throughout the entire kingdom of Persia, the Jews had killed 75,000 of their enemies. But it says they did not lay their hands on the plunder. They had every right to do so, but there are a number of reasons why they might not have done that. The first reason is it would show that on the part of the Jews, the fighting that took place on these 2 days did not arise from a place of personal vengeance. The Jews were not, you know, this was not an act of vengeance. They just wanted to survive. They weren't concerned about the treasure and the plunder of their enemies. They just wanted to survive. They wanted to be allowed to exist. And so they didn't take the treasure. And another thing that could have been accomplished and probably was accomplished, though it's not stated specifically, is that those who might have been orphaned or widowed by these who rose up in hatred against the Jews, who basically trapped themselves and destroyed themselves by their hatred, their widows and their orphans could keep their stuff and be able to, you know, to have some type of life, to survive in spite of the foolishness of, you know, whoever might have been involved in this. So it says that this was done on the 13th day of the month. And in the rural areas, they rested on the 14th day of the month and made it a feast and a time of rejoicing. The Jews in Susa assembled on the 13th day and the 14th day of the month, and they rested on the 15th day and made it a day of feasting and rejoicing. So in verse 19, there's two different times of observance for this feasting and this rejoicing. And what happens here at the end of chapter 9 is kind of reorganizing of the holiday to combine both the days into one celebration. So the rural areas aren't celebrating at a different time than the people in the cities. Everybody's celebrating both days. That's what's going to kind of end up happening. And this is a holiday that is still celebrated by the Jews today. It becomes established, it seems, by the authority of Mordecai and Esther throughout the generations of the Jewish people. And it's called Purim. And that name comes from Pur, which was the word for lot. Haman had cast the lot to determine the time of destruction. And Purim is just plural, the plural form of lot, you know, Purim. So it's the feast of the lots. And it's a remembrance of the Jews' deliverance, and the instructions for the celebration was that they would celebrate, what I'm looking here. Yeah, verse 22, I think. It should be a day of feasting and rejoicing, sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. That's basically how this was celebrated. A remembrance of the deliverance, rejoicing, you know, sharing food with friends, and particularly giving gifts to the poor. So all these instructions are kind of laid out, and it seems like Esther writes a letter confirming this with Mordecai, which may have been a letter. So the first letter is kind of reporting to all the Jews in the provinces what has happened. The Jews have been delivered. You know, none of the enemies of the Jews prevailed anywhere. And so we're going to, you know, make this a regular observance for our people to remember these days and remember the deliverance. And Esther, the note that Esther writes seems to include some instructions for lamentation and fasting in verse, fasting and lamentation in verse 31, presumably, you know, leading up to the feast. So you've got the fasting and the lamentation, the reminders of the, you know, the terrible danger that the Jewish people were in. And then you've got the 2 days of feasting on the 14th day and the 15th month that you rejoice and you remember. Now, there's an expression that I wanted to look at with you because I think it's important for us, and it's pretty typical. It's something that is at play constantly in the story of the Bible, and it's worth kind of thinking about it more specifically. At the end of verse 28, all this was done. All this was established and kind of, you know, put on record permanently and legally by Mordecai and Esther. It says, so that the memory would not fade from their descendants. There's a few things that I wrote down here that I wanted to talk about in connection with that expression, so that the memory of what had happened would not fade from their descendants. The faith of God's people must grow so that we will be equipped for trials and tests in the future. We talked about this. We talked about, I think on Sunday, we talked about many times today we find ourselves in complex situations and we need knowledge and faith and patience, and sometimes we need mercy, you know, mercy for ourselves as we try to make these decisions and do the best we can and keep trying to learn. We need a faith that helps us to function in the present. You know, there are general principles that are laid down, but circumstances change. Right now, we're living in times that no one has ever, you know, who is alive remembers. It's happened before, but not in our lifetimes. There's nothing quite like it that anyone's experienced. And so we've got to take these principles and we've got to live out the truth in the present. And that's kind of a progressive process. Maybe we don't always like to think of the word progressive with regard to our faith, but that is somewhat of a progressive process. So we need that aspect of our faith. But faith in God and our covenant with God is sustained by memory. It's always been true. We had a lesson not too long ago. Beware lest you forget God. You see, their covenant, their reliance, their relationship with God, it would be sustained by intentional memory. That's why they remember the Passover. They remember the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, they had the Day of Atonement. They remembered their sins. And the Lord's Supper, do this in remembrance of me. This has always been the way the Lord interacted with human beings. Yes, we need a faith that is progressive. We need to know how to, things change. You know, we need to know how to respond to technology, new threats. You know, all threats probably have a fundamental nature to them, but they can appear very differently. We need a faith to navigate through that. But faith does not abandon the past, and covenants do not abandon the past. They are sustained by memory. So here's some things I wrote down that we need to remember if we are to endure and persist in our relationship with God. We need to remember why we entered into a covenant with God in the first place. You know, for the Jews, they were born into it. But why did they, at some point in their lives, make the choice to honor it? For us as Christians, we make the choice to become Christians and to enter a covenant with God by the blood of Jesus Christ. And we need to remember why we did that. And it doesn't have to be very complicated. Probably will not be complicated. I realized that I was a sinner. I believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. And here's why. And I wanted to be free from the bondage of sin that I perceived by my own experiences and was confirmed by the scriptures. We need to remember why we entered into a covenant with God. We need to remember why we continue to serve God. Circumstances change. You know, maybe things are going well for a while. My bank account's up. Maybe it's down. Something happens suddenly or tragically. Am I going to continue to serve God tomorrow? I need to remember why. And that's part of what this was about. If you go through some bad times in the future, Jews, remember what happened to Mordecai and Esther. They waited on the Lord. They put their trust in the Lord. And what an incredible deliverance was accomplished. Not even with a miracle, so far as we can tell. The Lord is able to help those who put their trust in Him. So we remember why we continue to serve God. We remember ways that God has helped us in the past. And we remember that because if we're thinking God can't help us, our life is full of circumstances that we have come through. And there was a time when we were wondering, how will we come through this? How will I get to the other side with my faith intact? And the Lord brought us through that. We need to remember His people, the ways that they have helped us in the past, the good that they have done for us. And we need to remember that that's our family, that that's our heritage. And we need to carry that forward with us. We take the past with us. You know, it's not just that our progressive faith means that we abandon the past. We bring the past with us and the people of the past and the deliverances of the past. And this, I believe, this process of memory, I believe by practice, I believe scripture would bear this out, that's what's behind all these remembrances that God establishes for us, is that this is what grounds us. This is our anchor. And we might add that this can and should stir us up to serve others and to tell others about the hope that we have because of what God has done for us. When we see someone struggling, downcast, we say, friend, I've been where you are. I know you need the hope of the Lord. Let me tell you about the hope of the Lord and His deliverance. And, you know, we're talking about Jews, I know, but when you talk about the fundamental principles of our relationship with God, they're very similar. The worship is very different, but the fundamental principles of our relationship and keeping covenant are very similar. And I think we learn a lot from the faith of Esther and Mordecai. And we still may have questions about some of the things that they did. We talked about that. But in the end, what you see is a man who is Mordecai and Esther. And a lot of focus is on Mordecai here at the end. But Esther and Mordecai, to me, it seems, are a package deal. You don't have one without the other. What Esther did and what Esther didn't mean much without Mordecai, because Mordecai was in, you know, the position that he was, and vice versa. Mordecai did not have near the influence and ability to deal with the king that Esther. They're a package deal, and their faith worked together to help one another and bring about this great deliverance and to invoke the power of God by their faith. You know, we may have questions about some of the things that they did, but if you look in chapter 10, Mordecai is not just remembered as some guy that God used, like Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, there's no portrayal of Nebuchadnezzar as a moral man or even an honorable man from the standpoint of, he was just, a really, benevolent, kind and just kind of ruler. Now, there's a lot of evidence that would suggest maybe some of the opposite about Nebuchadnezzar. But look at Mordecai is not just some man that God used. Mordecai is described as one who sought the good of his people in verse 3, and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. In this book, he is not just recognized, he's celebrated. And so we may have questions about some of the choices that Mordecai, and I'm just saying that because, you know, because look, I think we all would like more information about Esther and Mordecai's character. But I think there is enough information for us to realize that there is, you know, they weren't just tools that could be used. They were used because of some fundamental attributes of their character. And I think I think this makes the most sense to me. Why does it talk about Ahasuerus and his tribute and the accomplishments of his authority? I think all of that is introduced in verses 1 and 2 by way of comparison to argue for the greatness of Mordecai. So here's Ahasuerus and here's his greatness, the realm of his empire and the taxes that he levied and the authority that he exercised in levying those taxes. He had the power not just to levy them, but to collect them. And then it says that Mordecai was second only to King Ahasuerus. I think for the point of comparison, the king was great. He's over this great empire and he exercised power, and Mordecai was the second highest ranking official in that great and awesome kingdom. But Mordecai, you know, was not just, again, a tool. He was an intentional advocate for the people of God. And I would just leave us with this evening. We can imitate Mordecai and Esther by seeking the welfare of God's people, the welfare of our neighbors, and speaking words of peace and truth. Notice that in verse 30, and it describes the letters that Esther and Mordecai wrote. This was important to them, and their authority was behind the instructions that they gave to their countrymen. But it says in verse 30 that the words that they wrote were words of peace and truth. And of course, that is the currency that God's people ought to be dealing in. So what can we learn from Mordecai and Esther? Seek the welfare of God's people. Seek the welfare of our neighbors. Speak words of peace and truth. And I hope that you have seen in our reading, you know, the past couple of days, that this book is highly spiritual and highly practical for God's people today. I know kind of I had my mind was different places. Maybe we got a little off track along the way, but maybe we got some good points for you to take with you for the rest of this week. Lord willing, on Sunday, we'll be going back to the book of Ezra and finishing up Ezra 7 through 10. And so just be doing your reading, getting ready for Sunday. Lord willing, we'll have those discussions and hopefully we'll be able to say something that's helpful. We're going to learn something this week and learn something about God and learn something that we can use to help others. Let's go ahead and have a word of prayer this evening and we'll be done for tonight. Our God and Father in heaven, we thank you so much for your word. We pray that you would help us to learn its lessons. Pray that you would help us to be humble as we make our judgments and trying to determine the goodness of actions and the rightness or the wrongness of actions, and just to be patient as we make those judgments and strive to see the simple truths that you want us to see. And always, Father, striving to see your hand working behind the scenes, even if no miracles are taking place, to know that you are watching over your people, that you are faithful to your promises, and Father, that we who have been offered salvation through Jesus Christ are the most blessed people who have ever lived. And we pray that we would acknowledge that fact, take advantage of that fact by striving to live for Christ who died for us and imitating his love by showing love to others, being willing to give of ourselves and being stirred up by the knowledge of the love of Christ, and and to tell and to proclaim. And Father, help us to rejoice in you. There are circumstances going on that might make us anxious in the world and our country. But Father, help us to rejoice in you, for others to see that we have hope in you, and that we would be aware and ready to use opportunities to share that hope throughout this week. And pray that you just help us to be filled with your love, to show mercy to others as we try to help them. And Father, that we'd be willing to show mercy to ourselves as we try to learn and grow in our faith, that we would hold on to the past, that the past would be an anchor for us, past truths, past commitments and decisions that we have made, that they would be an anchor for us as we try to take the next step day by day. Lord, however much time we may be given through this week, help us to use it well, to acknowledge your blessings each and every day. Father, we thank you so much for your mercy, that you would forgive us, that you would take the time to teach us and help us to grow and to learn. And Father, forgive us and cleanse us, and be with our brethren that we've been praying about and mentioning, those who are ill and those who have been restricted and really felt the limitations of some of the health restrictions that have been set in place. Help them not to lose heart. Be with the families who are caring for those who are shut in, Father, and keep us safe and give us good rest through the night. We pray in Jesus' name and amen. Okay, brethren, Lord willing, we'll see you on Sunday. May God bless you throughout the rest of this week.